So today I'm joined by Andy Burrows. Andy Burrows is an online safety, dare I use the E word, you are an online safety expert because you are an online safety campaigner and you are an advisor to the Molly Rose Foundation. So thank you for joining me today, Andy. And
Yes.
whew, here we go. Right. So first of all, why do you do what you do in this space and what drew you to working with the companies that you have done and moving to working with companies like the Molly Rose Foundation, and of course, providing balanced middle of the road driver evidence to larger corporations, organizations, and services.
Yeah, so I've been in the children's space for about just under 10 years, and I started my career in regulation and in consumer protection. One of the things that really jumped out to me was that, so often the needs of users and the needs of vulnerable users don't get a look in when it comes to regulation, when it comes to kind of corporate decision making. And the more vulnerable you are, and there's no more vulnerable group clearly than children, the less your needs tend to get understood and factored in. And that was the kind of, challenge for me when I came into the children's space, because you have this extraordinary, position where, social media products, where tech products, online services have become so fundamental to children's lives. But in any other aspect of children's lives, we have reasonable expectations. You go to the playground, there's not going to be rusty nails on the swing. You go to the swimming pool and there's going to be a lifeguard in place. How have we got to the stage where online is so fundamental to children's lives, but the idea of, basic standards of safeguarding and thinking about the risks and making sure they're designed out, it's not only that it's not there, but it's become this ferocious political battle to try and make it delivered.
Wow. Oh, aren't we starting off with a bang here in terms of actually that I've seen as that, well, the internet wasn't designed for children. So I do find these backpedaling statements that exist in this space in terms of that high-end political challenge that we both see in the online space. But I think that sometimes that's because people suggest to you, well, it's because the internet wasn't designed for children. And actually, if we go with Sonia Livingston and the research she's been doing for a long time, a third of the internet users are children. So absolutely. So how do you think we got to this space then without the safeguards?
And that's a hugely important, that stat is hugely important. One in three internet users are children. Because, not only is this an issue then that one in three users are children, and so, demand and require a higher level of safety because they are fundamentally children, but it's also like a democratic argument. It's a fundamentally pluralistic argument. Try finding me another service, another product where a third of users are being disadvantaged because, they are vulnerable and their needs are not being met. And then there is a battle to try and make sure that, there's even a sense of legitimacy of making sure that their voices are heard. Look, I think a lot of this, a lot of this goes back to the kind of philosophy of the internet. The internet is going to be this kind of transformative set of, social goods, and there's a kind of positive naivety there, which, has then been wrapped up in how Silicon Valley has been developed, in this kind of sense of tech libertarianism. But there's then some very, very strong founding principles about how the internet should be designed and run. Now, on the one hand, that is from corporates, but on the other, actually a lot of this is about, the internet should be, delivered in a way that promotes free expression and it promotes privacy, but those being seen as, absolute ends in and of themselves, when, in reality, you can't have such a thing as a single right that you pursue over all others. There has to be a balance. And ultimately, like everything else, tech is about power. Children are, the constituency probably with the least power, but with the greatest set of needs. And, the least say, the least power, but, really requiring that extra enhanced level of needs. So it's probably not a surprise that then, children at best have been an afterthought. And those of us who are pushing to try and make sure that the online world is fundamentally safer by design for children, we can just be caricatured and dismissed as a moral panic.
Oh my goodness, you just went into my favorite realm in terms of the metaphysical approach to what Heidegger called techne. So that takes us, but I mean that's a let's stay off that, Kath, because this is not this is not where we're going, right? But there is something about technology influences and changes us, and that change we haven't seen. We haven't really got the evidence at this point in time in terms of what that's done to human development, particularly child development, et cetera, et cetera. But my goodness, yes, that idea that there is nowhere else, not one space, would we allow this to happen. So I wonder if the next question might be, so why do you think there's this power battle in terms of what we're facing now? Because I'm going to go into this ban, not ban debate in terms of right now. The power battle that's going on is technology companies say that they're doing their best to protect children, and there's a little bit of bunkum in that because it's they're doing their best whilst providing the highest retention rates, versus the parents that don't necessarily understand research in its entirety. I'm not saying parents can't understand research here, but what I'm finding is there's the polarity of, well, we've heard one, let's I'm not even going to name him today, right? But we've heard one particular academic in the space that's making a lot of noise. And we seem to be in this huge polemic space at the moment about, well, if we just get rid of them, Andy, if we ban them and we don't actually allow children on phones or whatever it is that we're trying to do, because my point entirely here would be, but then what do we do with consoles? What do we do with computers? What do we do with the fact that there's libraries? What do we do with the fact that other people have got older age children and siblings and dot, 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 ellipses, ellipses? Where do we go from here? What, how do you think we've got to this? So this mess.
You know what? We've got this mess because we've allowed it to get to the stage where it has reached a mess. I'm, completely averse to the polemics of this space as well. And you've got a rush right now towards, actually what looks and feels like a moral panic. You go to university and you learn in your first year, the kind of the difference between correlation and causation. And it seems right now that a lot of the people advocating for smartphone bans have forgotten some of those kind of first year lectures. Maybe they missed the lectures those weeks. I don't know. But one of the reasons that, those books are getting written, those books are getting sold. People can charge 36 quid a ticket to give lectures on their meta-narrative view of the world.
Yeah.
Is because actually, the concern is there and the concern is vocal. And clearly, the groundswell of parental groups arguing for smartphone bans, arguing for really tough new restrictions. I don't agree with those approaches at all because, there are fantastic opportunities in the online world can be fantastic for children. But, the groundswell of that support, polling a couple of weeks ago showing that a majority of parents of primary school children actually support a total ban on smartphones, that tells you that something has gone badly wrong. And, I think the solutions that are being proposed around bans are entirely wrong, but something has gone badly wrong. Now, what has gone badly wrong is that we have seen, this extraordinary situation where, kind of for well over a decade, the tech companies were effectively able to hold governments in a trance. And, there was this nervousness, So when I came into the space, the PR lobbyists had the most fantastically easy ride, like the tech's too hard. You can't regulate. You can't do this at the nation state level. It has to be internationally or not at all. Guess what? You can. And as the years have gone by, we've chipped by at those narratives. But it means then that we've reached a point where, in lots of brilliant ways, but also lots of harmful ways, online is now clearly ubiquitous to all of our lives, but especially to children's lives. We know that children don't have that distinction between, an online life and an offline life in the way that maybe we as adults do. And because that's been self-regulated, because we've seen companies just being able to, employ some of the sharpest minds available, whether that is, designing products, whether that is understanding kind of child psychology, in order to create, these compelling I hate to use the word addictive, but kind of products that are designed to keep eyeballs on screen for as long as possible, with product design that is ruthlessly driven on understanding what will keep us coming back for more. Because those products have been designed in a way where the objective is profit maximization, not safety by design and well-being by design, then we have a really big problem. And unfortunately, the problem is, once you design these products, going backwards, retrofitting this so that they're safe is the challenge.
Now, I don't know if I don't know if you know this, but my children are grown up now. They're in the latter end of their 20s. So I've grown up with computers since being quite little. I'm not going to tell you my age, but since being quite little. And then my children were introduced to it around 3, 4 years of age so that they could become skilled and developed with the technology. But what I don't know whether this is a so I've posited this in books, and I suggest this especially when I'm teaching therapists, which is what I really want to try and get to grips with in terms of what we're talking about today. What do you think to the idea that I think the narrative around parenting has been we allowed our children into a space that was unregulated? So I often use a metaphor of like a city park or maybe a shopping centre. And that when those children have gone into the shopping centre or the park, and actually it turns out that there are bad actors in those spaces, that what we've done is that backpedaling. And what I find with a lot of the parents that I work with directly in therapy, if for example, I go back to 2013, I was working with an 8-year-old child, and the parents said, "But we didn't know this." And I said, "Well, in one sense, why was your child in this space if you didn't know or understand it?" "Oh, because it's technology." And the word technophobe was used over a decade ago. But what I'm seeing now is I think there's an element of shame in parents that have allowed their children into these spaces. And what shame does when you kind of unpick it and deconstruct it is it produces this anger. And I think that's what's coming from parents at the minute. Because the tech is pointing at the parents, the government is pointing at the parents are pointing at the technology companies, the parents are pointing at the teachers. And unfortunately, as I've always said, and the chasm in the middle is where the children sit that get exploited by the technology companies. So I don't use the word addictive, I use the terminology exploitative. Now, we don't allow children to be exploited in other spaces because that's illegal.
And I think that makes loads of sense. And I think one of the problems, and this is one of the areas where I've got actually a lot of sympathy for parents, is that I think it has been mighty hard for lots of parents to actually understand necessarily just the truly exploitative nature of these platforms, and to understand the nature of some of the risks that they can present. And lots of parents will sit there and they'll put YouTube on for their kids and they'll feel guilty about it. But kind of that's also just kind of your parents with young children leading a busy life, and and you'll feel bad about that. But actually, oh, I took myself off. But yeah. Actually, I think a lot of parents actually haven't really understood just the way in which a lot of the products are, designed very, very ruthlessly. I think about Molly's story, and when Molly died in 2017, that was a year after Instagram started to introduce, personalized algorithmic recommendations, and the extent to which that was a game changer, in terms of then ruthlessly identifying the content that we are interested in, showing us more and more of it. If you're thinking then about kind of child sexual abuse, that was the biggest boon imaginable to groomers, because then you could start to contact children at scale. And I mean, literally, you didn't have to do any more than refresh your screen to get a fresh list of personalized suggestions. You can very quickly get a sense of what children are interested in, what habits. And it's those decisions under the bonnet which, I think, I'm not sure. Well, we can't blame parents for, kind of not understanding the full extent of the risks that have come out, because actually, we've just seen some of the, most ruthless aspects of product design that we have seen, in the last century, targeting children for the pursuit of profit.
Oh my goodness, yes. And whilst, in fact, let's not get into fear mongering, but let's talk about the scale of the problem, the reality of the problem, because the idea that you could, and I think the way I like to use metaphors so that the listeners can under, for those that aren't watching and me waving my hands, the metaphor that I tend to go with is imagine walking down a street where you, I don't know, you've got the latest pair of glasses on that allow you to see adverts. It's a little bit like the Minority Report where you're walking through maybe the bus station and each bus has the number on the front, but every advert on the side of the bus is specific to you, and every advert for every shop that's in the shopping centre is specific for you. That would really, I think that would terrify parents if they realised that was happening to their children. But I suspect many of us have moved into this space carefully and slowly. And if I relate it to coercive relationships, this is what I call the ice block of chip, chip, chip away until you have a beautiful ice sculpture. Many people don't see it happening in the moment. It's only when you retrospectively look back. So I think. And I'm watching a number of accounts on social media doing this at the moment where they're creating their own, you know, this is me setting up a 14-year-old on Snapchat. This is me being an 11-year-old on such and such a platform. And then what they do is they wait for the algorithms to show them the content. They're filming it and then showing it to the public. That can be really scary. So how can we talk about the scale of the problem and how can we educate parents? And I'm going to use this phrase that you used when we first talked about doing this podcast in a child-centered way, because I think we do it in a parent-centered way or an adult-centered way, and we forget the children have to be in some of these spaces. Now, that's not social media, before anybody gets on my back. There is this thing about they have to be in these spaces of digital technology because digital technology is their home. This is where it's not going away. So I'm going to leave the ideas and the way you think we should be doing this to you for a few minutes.
Yeah, do you know, one of the things that has really struck me in recent years is when Ofsted produced their report off the back of Everyone's Invited. And, what they were talking about was the extent to which, those dynamics that underpin so much of the, the bad things that we're talking about of, coercion and a lack of consent and control had become normalized. And, so when Ofsted went and did that research, they found a picture of, amongst teenage girls, this sense that, being asked for, being encouraged to send self-generated images of themselves, naked selfies, had become normalized. I remember sitting in a focus group a few years ago, and it was really, really startling. Kind of a teenage girl said, that when she'd sent self-generated images, actually the fact that then they'd been shared around the school, actually there was an element of, that happened to me and it was horrible, and it will happen to someone else next week and someone else the week after that. The bit that really upset her, which in and of itself is really, really devastating and disturbing to hear. But what upset her was then, kind of that lack of control, and that her sense of trust had been broken. The fact that then it had been shared widely was almost kind of secondary and ancillary for her. But that to me, says something really profound, that to get to the stage where, those really unhealthy dynamics of, of coercion and of, seeing teenagers being, kind of encouraged to, almost view sending images to, do things that might make them feel uncomfortable, almost being the kind of like price of admission of going on to online services, that is something that is, really troubling. And it says that something has gone badly wrong. And I think, when we look at this through the kind of like child-centered or young person-centered lens, let's start from the worldview that they now inhabit, which is, of that situation of, teenage girls then, viewing this as, a kind of horrible, but, kind of almost priced in sense of what it is to be a young person online today. If you look at if you look at kind of the way in which young people can be bombarded by harmful content online, one of the things that really struck me from some research that I did a few months ago was seeing young people being exposed to suicide and self-harm content and almost using the algorithm as a barometer for the state of their mental health. So showing me, I'm seeing lots of harmful content in my feed again. I guess I must be ill. And so those two things tell me a couple of things. Firstly, if we start from where children and young people are today, they are, all too aware of the nature of the online risks that they are facing. And I think, there's a real sense from, from teenagers and from children and young people that, the online world is fantastic, but they want to see those issues being tackled. But secondly, as well, I think, sometimes lots of us as adults in this space, whether, that's as parents or teachers or clinicians or therapists or whoever it might be, we have a squeamishness about kind of opening up a Pandora's box on these issues, when actually this is what children and teenagers are navigating every day in their lives. And so, I don't want to kind of scaremonger and, kind of say, like overstate the scale of this problem. But actually, the stats speak for themselves. Research at the NSPCC found that about 200,000 children have likely been groomed. That will be something that's happening to children, to teenagers in every class up and down the country. So, those, the scale of this actually is something that, all of us will deal with, whether that is with our own children, whether that is, kind of teachers in class, whether that is, kind of then professionals, working in whatever kind of safeguarding role this will be. Children and teenagers are living this day in, day out. We as adults sometimes are being, I think, overly squeamish by not starting from a teen centered view of the world, which is that, this has become a kind of lived reality.
Well, I'm actually going to knock it down a bit lower in terms of what I'm doing in my PhD at the minute, Andy, because actually one of the things that the 7-year-olds said to me in the research, but they also say it in the clinic, is, but the companies should take this stuff off before we see it. And what a wise little person says that. And that's the argument that we're not having in terms of and why would a 7-year-old need to say that? Well, it's because they're encountering it. And there's something about where I come from in terms of my cyber trauma and online harms approach is that affects that child in many ways. And obviously it'll be when I publish the PhD, that affects a child in so many different ways. And if you think about taking your child into, I'm going to go back to that city park metaphor. If you take your child into a city park in this country, in the United Kingdom, you would not expect to see corporal and capital punishment taking place. But if you go on Snapchat, of course, a 7-year-old shouldn't be on Snapchat, but they don't have to be on Snapchat. They can be with their siblings, their cousins, their family members, whomever, somebody on the bus or whatever and wherever, football club or I don't know, sports club of some description. And somebody shows them that image, that's the same as being on. And this is why I think we're getting the whole approach wrong at the moment. So this idea of just ban the smartphones means that if you go to Black Mirror and Archangel, which is an episode that I've talked about in one of my books, actually we can't necessarily stop this. What we have to do is have conversations about how we prevent and mitigate most of it in the first instance. And that's certainly going to require, I suspect, conversations with tech companies. So that level of discord means, okay, how did it, not the app, by the way, that level of discord is going to create this kind of battle, I suspect, between what we do that's right and true for children's physiological, psychological, and mental health and well-being versus how these companies can, in air quotes, keep children on their platforms because they're the ones using the grooming techniques in terms of the manipulation for how they keep children on the platforms.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And ultimately, and you're totally right to kind of talk about this game of kind of ping pong between, kind of parents and companies and governments and, who takes responsibility, who should take responsibility, and ultimately, I mean, parents have a crucial role to play here, of course they do, around being able to, kind of equip their kids with the, the kind of understanding of, and this is about online, but it's broader than online, but of, kind of those kind of critical skills of, kind of consent and control and feeling uncomfortable and, about kind of digital literacy, so it's great to hear that young kids are saying, don't serve me that content, but understanding, kind of why you're getting the content being served. That you are, kind of what happens if you have the uncomfortable experience. And that's where, kind of parents and schools and frontline professionals have a huge role to play in helping to, kind of equip our kids with that sense of kind of, critical literacy. And that really does start from a young age, as you're saying, because, kind of we figures from Ofcom last week, and for better or worse, when we've got, huge proportions of young, of, of primary school age children, using social networks, engaging with content, then we have to make sure that this, message is flexed to really, really, to not, the kind of, we can all understand why we then, start worrying about these issues when it gets to like 10, 11, 12, but, the genie's out of the bottle at that point. But, the thing I would say is that then, the onus can't be on parents for as long as, we have children using products that are fundamentally unsafe by design. And parents will only ever be catching up on, kind of new devices, new apps, new products for as long as they are fundamentally unsafe by design. So the only way that we ever see progress on this is by recognizing, forgive the horrible wonky phrase, but that it's a whole system approach. You regulate these products so they're safe. You have, kind of a clear strategy to make sure the messaging in schools around digital literacy and online safety and online civility is strong. You have a really clear role for, kind of therapists and clinicians to help, kind of children who, kind of are encountering this stuff as part of their, as part of their lives, not as part of their online lives, as part of their lives. And you have a role for parents around, kind of around prevention. But it's a whole system approach, and all of those things have to be working, or we fail.
Yes, I love this. I want to get into the how do we help professionals understand this? And the reason I'm saying that is because parents are professionals. Professionals are parents. I've noticed if ever I'm teaching, I can see what I call the parent look in the professional, and it's and you almost see this. Oh my God, I did that. I let my child on that. And one, gosh, this is going back a number of years. I think it must have been about 2017. One therapist started crying when I was teaching, trainee therapist, should I say, because I was talking about groomers online and so on and so forth. And she said, I let my child on that every single day without watching. And so it can be scary, but I do know we do have hundreds and thousands of resources that are in the provision of online safety companies. There are digital literacy programs and media literacy programs taking place in school. So how do we get to the professionals in, I think you called it a wonky phrase. It's a societal issue, but this has to be, now I'm going to talk like a therapist, top down and bottom up, because the only way you can get integrated care is to be left, right, up and down when we generally talk about the brain. So how do we do this? How do we talk about the level of issues that are happening so that the listeners being professionals, maybe GPs, therapists, teachers. Do you want to talk about the scale of the problem in different areas? So some of that revealing reality research, and obviously what you've worked with, because you've been with the NSPCC before and now Molly Rose.
Yeah, do you know, so look, the scale of the problem is really considerable. It is startling. When you look at, if you go on to say TikTok or Instagram, the algorithm, the scale of algorithmically recommended harmful content is staggering. So I went through and analyzed hundreds and hundreds of posts of suicide and self-harm content. Those serve as de facto messaging boards with, kind of thousands of comments from very often desperate children. Those posts are, amplified ruthlessly. So, some of those posts are attracting, well, more than half of, kind of the posts that I went through and analyzed, the most engaged posts posted using suicide and self-harm hashtags, had been viewed and liked well over 1 million times. Some of them have been, viewed and liked, millions and millions of times. So, that shows you that, the algorithms, the way the products are designed, are pushing harmful content out to huge numbers of children. When you see, kind of grooming and sexual abuse, it's not by accident that, kind of 90% of the material that the Internet Watch Foundation now sees are self-generated images where kind of either teenagers have been coerced into sending materials, or they've, kind of sent images and then they've fallen into the wrong hands. So then once you, kind of lose control of that image, you've lost control of that image. There is a scale to these issues that, without scaremongering, requires a recognition that, kind of this is a problem that, the vast majority of teens will encounter, online harms, kind of unfortunately on a regular basis. So, for the vast majority of teens, that won't necessarily tip out into being a problem and one where they will have effects. But for a not inconsiderable number of teens, they will be on the receiving end of, of harmful content or a harmful experience that has the potential to then go on and cause harm to them. And because, this is a, you have a problem, you ultimately have products that have been built to be negligent by design because profit maximization over well-being and safety has been the order of the day. So that flows down into, products and services that, the vast majority of children and teenagers, increasingly from younger and younger in ages, are using. Now, online can be fantastic, and there are fantastic positive use cases from children being online, but there's also the potential for things to go wrong. So if you are a clinician, if you are, an educator, if you are a frontline professional, it's important that we don't scaremonger, but it's also important that we recognize the scale and the nature of these problems. And that we recognize that because these are things that children and teens are living through every single day, to go back to, kind of that Ofsted report, we as adults can't afford to be squeamish about this because children and teens don't have the luxury of being squeamish about this. So, it's startling sometimes to hear, to hear professionals say they feel uncomfortable about some of these issues. They feel uncomfortable talking about this space. They're worried about what happens if they start asking questions to a child who, kind of perhaps has experienced harmful content or has experienced sexual abuse. But, the reality is that, we can't afford not to engage with these issues because they are taking place at a scale that, unfortunately is affecting far too many children and young people.
So it's I'm thinking there's something about knowledge about the issues that exist and the nomenclature, the kind of ways to recognize it. So I'm thinking actually in terms of if you were speaking to, I don't know, an audience of GPs or psychiatrists or my profession in terms of the psychotherapy and counseling, what I tend to do is say, well, when you ask somebody how they are, you're generally making an assumption that you know the environment in which they live, because that's how therapists and GPs are talk to people. But what we don't do is we don't have that imagined space, and we're going back into the metaphysical now, so I'll just be careful. You don't have that imagined space where I will say to people, so what are you watching on Netflix at the minute? What are what are you doing, or what's your favorite platform to use on your smartphone, or what games are you playing? So it's almost like I go into the same space as the children. I don't specifically ask, oh, have you played Call of Duty or have you been on GTA? Because the children will often tell you that the moment you open up that discussion of, oh, you're talking tech, it becomes a space where I can talk to you about the issues. Now, I do have an example of where I was working in some schools in 2010 and 2011 as a PHSE sex education teacher. Whilst we were given instruction, so to speak, not to talk about pornography, actually that conversation needs talking about, and we need to really get comfortable with the uncomfortable topics, I suspect. So What would be your go-to list if there was a list in terms of topics that professionals should speak about? I would suggest that they go through all 67 different types of cyber traumas that I'm up to at the moment. That would take too long, and clinicians might only have 10 minutes. What would you suggest people need to quickly learn about to be able to bring into their lexicon and to be able to work with in the clinician's setting, so to speak?
So I think it's so important that clinicians have an understanding of, of the kind of common types of risks, the common types of experiences that we know that children will be encountering, which is sexual abuse, which is grooming, which is coercion. It's about kind of suicide and self-harm content. It's about pro-Anna content. It's about misogynistic content and the way in which unhealthy attitudes towards sex and relationships kind of run rife. And Andrew Tate as this kind of infamous cause, as this infamous case where we can see the impact that that has had on a generation of young boys, but also on a generation of men, kind of distorting their views of sex and relationships. So, I think there's, it's really important that clinicians can have that understanding of, kind of these types of issues, the kind of, the kind of level of the typologies of kind of those harms that, kind of we know children are experiencing at scale, but also, understands the way in which online is central to young people's lives, and understand the way in which, even if you don't, kind of understand, you don't have to understand the fine details of product decisions, of the way in which platforms work, the kind of fine details of algorithms, but understand fundamentally that those are products that have not been built, they have not been tested with safety and well-being at mind. So be open to the fact that children will be having experiences that may be new to you, that may be novel, that will be changing, kind of like day in, day out. But they are having to navigate a world that is like laden, it's fused with risks and harms. And being open to that understanding of how the products have been designed and all the ways in which that has the potential for harm, yes, understand there's kind of like baseline level of harms, but be open to, kind of the fact that this is something that's constantly changing, that's fused with risk. And, let children have that conversation with you, let them start that journey of, kind of disclosing, sharing their experiences, and don't be scared of having those conversations and worrying about kind of what Pandora's box you're opening up, because it's a crucial part of children's lives. You can't, kind of put your fingers in your ears and just hope that that bit doesn't come up.
Well, my feeling around this at the moment is this is why I think people want to ban it, because then you don't have to have those conversations. But actually, A, those harms have possibly already happened. And B, how do you then equip children with the skills to be able to manage in those environments? For example, lots of children know how to block, ban, report. They've got those three words in that order, and quite often they'll say, oh yeah, I just block, ban and report them. Now, I'm well aware with the children I work with, they do tell me that reporting stuff is not worth its time because you don't get any feedback. But also, they will quite often in my office, they will report players who have beaten them in a game, for example. So I know that there will be a large amount of information that's time wasting, so to speak, in that reporting process. But actually, the incredibly important stuff, if anybody has, and I'm just thinking about the people that might be listening, if ever you've tried to report something, you'll see that you can label it. So often it would be fantastic actually if there was more feedback for us when we do report things. But certainly I've been exposed to a lot of the harms that children are exposed to because of what I do for my PhD, and I suspect that your internet history and algorithms drive stuff towards you as well, Andy, in terms of what we do puts us into that space. But that idea of opening that can of worms and having those conversations, how can we support the professionals in knowing the routes that they can go down? Because even now, when I speak to some schools, and every time this happens, I have to swallow quite hard and go, okay, not everybody's tech savvy, Kath, But I can be in a school that have never heard of the Southwest Grid for Learning, for example, or I can be in a school that doesn't know that there are particular platforms. And what I often get asked, and I'm suspecting this is so common in my youth safety colleagues as well, so what are the platforms that are dangerous? And I have to say, well, it's not the platform, it's the people that frequent them. So
Yeah.
how do we even get this knowledge out that could be, I wonder if a Netflix movie or something would be helpful here, because we've had the social dilemma, which puts a particular slant on things. Do you think there needs to be mandatory training for people who work with children and adolescents to understand this space? Do you think we need to make it mandatory, really?
Do you know what? I think there should be mandatory training, but I think, this isn't just about kind of making people sit down and do a training course. This is about making sure that the resources are there and they're really high quality to help professionals understand these issues. And, it's fantastic now that, kind of we see, kind of sex education, kind of we see online safety being built into RSE. But, there's so much more that we need to do. Not only to, kind of make sure that it's on the curriculum, but to then make sure that, kind of teachers feel empowered to do justice to these issues. Because I think it's really clear, kind of when you speak to teachers, when you speak to the teaching unions, these are the issues that they're seeing every single day. And you can see why, people turn around and say, let's just ban this because, kind of we just don't know how to deal with it. But actually, let's make sure that the resources are there, that they're high quality, that teachers who I think are crying out for high quality materials to know how to do justice to these lessons, to know, they can see the harms that are affecting children. Let's make sure that those resources are in place so that they can feel comfortable, empowered to do justice on this. And I think, it will always be, we will always be chasing our tails if it is a kind of, which platforms are high risk, kind of like what's this week's harms, and I can think of appalling examples of online safety advice of, like flashing lights and exclamation marks on the screen of, like online safety alert, here's this week's app, and and really bad examples of that. But if we
No,
start.
I'm laughing because I'm going to ask you, how do people go and find those good resources? Because yes, that's oh, I mean, this is the space we're in at the moment, and I find it really difficult because since the word AI, and I'm doing the air quotes for those that can't listen, AI, as soon as we began to talk about AI, I am now seeing people in the online safety space that really do not understand technology. They don't understand children's lives on the technology. So how can we point professionals to good resources? And by good, I mean ones that are evidenced, ones that are provided by professionals who have been in this space for a long time, who are looking at the research. So certainly my go-to sending people at the moment is the Pete Etchells book. I say go and read that because
Yeah.
that will give you some in-depth knowledge. Obviously, I tell people to read mine, but they're written in a clinical, well, no, they're not written in a clinical way. They're written in a way that I talk to my clients, helping them understand, but I don't give them, and here's how to block this, here's how to block that. So how can people use their critical thinking? Because my goodness, there's some shite out there. Not to die. So how do they separate the wheat from the chaff in this space?
You know what? So I would say, if we are, when you're seeing content that is like, here's this week's scary new app, like here's this week's scary new feature, like that content is actually just learning exactly the worst of the tech companies and then applying it to this space. It's going to keep you coming back for more because next week there'll be a terrifying new app. Next week there'll be a scary new feature. So, when you're looking at the types of material that we're seeing, go for the ones that actually stand the test of time. Because the apps, the platforms will change, the kind of the new design features will change. And of course, it's really important to kind of keep across those and, kind of understand what, kind of TikTok looks like or Pinterest looks like or whatever, kind of whatever those apps are. But actually, kind of is this the good materials, I think, are the ones that, actually are a little bit technology neutral. They're not dependent on, like, this week's new shiny new app and new fear of the day. So is this talking about, like, those fundamental underlying principles, consent, control, power? Why are you seeing this content? What happens if something makes you feel uncomfortable, that you have the agency and the autonomy as a child and a teen to say, no, I don't want to do that, and then the practical steps that you could take. And I think if you're looking at the resources that are looking at those, kind of things that stand the test of time, not the kind of, here's this week's scary thing, then you're probably looking in the right place. And also as well, that engages with the nuance, that engages with the kind of complexity of this space, that recognizes that online can be fantastic, but it comes with risks. Something that feels so, I think approach the materials that you're looking at with, that kind of sense of critical literacy. If it feels, go for the stuff that actually feels like it has really engaged with these issues.
And maybe the same. Well, no, not maybe. It's definitely the same for those that promote parental controls and the kinds of things that you can do. Because I think again, there's a lot of, and I'm going to be very careful that I don't get that start heading into libel at the moment. But there are a number of services that I see provided, which again, given that my background is kind of cybersecurity data protection, I do not trust the fact that these services are saying that they're there to protect children. It feels more like there's an ulterior, insidious data collecting going on. So I would certainly say that there are things that you can do in order to protect devices and so on and so forth. But I'm also aware that recently, I think Sonia Livingston did another piece of research that showed that the parental controls weren't being used to full effect, nor did parents effectively rely on them. So maybe there's something about not only does it have to be a service that talks about what's happening online, but also how to put preventative measures in place. And I would love to see all of the trauma stuff that says afterwards, and here's what you do when it goes wrong, because that's effectively where I come from, is yes, those risks exist, but then what? What happens when?
And the problem with those who were saying either let's ban the smartphones, or who were saying let's have really intrusive parental controls, and one of the things that has been, being briefed out of Downing Street in the last few days is, this idea of if your child's encountered harmful content, then you as a parent could get an alert on your phone. And it makes me so worried. It makes me so worried. And just look at your face, Kat. The potential for unintended consequences. You mentioned that Sonia Livingston research. I really hope Rishi Sunak would sit and read that paper from start to finish, because, all the evidence says, parental controls have a role to play, but well-designed parental controls that look and feel like surveillance, that start to feel intrusive. The evidence is absolutely clear on this, that it results in worse outcomes. It weakens the relationship of trust between parents and children. It will make children less likely to disclose if something bad happens to them. And you will have seen this from the children coming in to see you. I've seen it through, the kind of the very worst cases that I've seen, that, if children encounter negative and harmful experiences online, and they feel like they can't disclose because they feel like they're going to be in trouble, then that is where those cases escalate. And then, the worst cases I can think of are those cases where children don't feel like they can come and seek help. And, those approaches that are built on, meeting a parental demand to, kind of make these problems go away, rather than being built in a sense of evidence, being built in a sense of being trauma informed, being built in a sense of what works. I mean, call me an old-fashioned centrist dad here, but, kind of like what works? Evidence. That is what has to drive approaches in this space. And right now we're in a point where, kind of like, those of us who are, working ferociously in this space to try and make sure that we can see, good effective legislation, good effective regulation, we're having to work a lot harder than we should to actually say evidence, nuance, that's what should drive this.
Yes, so we have a term in it gets a lot of different phrases, but we have a term in certainly in child psychotherapy with a particular lens of the smother mother. So this is far more intrusive than a helicopter parent, And that certainly, that surveillance type parenting creates shame, creates lack of trust. And then what happens is children rebel against the smother mother. Those are the children that I work with a lot. And I have to work carefully with parents to say, okay, allow them to be on the space. And there is this, it's hard. I've been through it myself with my children. So, I've raised boys. We had conversation. I must have been an embarrassing parent coming home from sex education and talking to them about, okay, so this your age group and your age group, and I'd be pointing at them, goes, they're looking at these kind of pornography sites. What are you finding with your mates, or what are you all talking about? Actually, it's really hard as a parent to allow your children to risk take, knowing there is a chance they can become hurt, and you feel the guilt as a parent. So sometimes this is definitely that commanding, demanding parenting that says, but if I don't allow them to take risks, then what happens is then they don't have any harms. But actually, internally, the psychological and emotional harm can be twice as much when it then goes into the rebellious space.
This risk taking is such a crucial, important part of adolescence, right? Kind of we learn and discover by making mistakes, by setting those boundaries. So, it may feel that, kind of like we the way in which we can keep children safe is just to pull up the drawbridge so there's not the potential to be exposed to risks. But actually, it is through that discovery, through that, expression, through that identity, through being able to kind of, gradually learn, be exposed to those situations that, may feel uncomfortable, that may have the potential for risk, that actually, we learn those skills. We learn those skills by doing. And yes, of course, we should be making sure that when kids are going online, through legislation, through regulation, that those products are fundamentally, kind of much safer. But I look at this as like, there's two options. There's one where, we are, seeing kind of, gradually safer platforms, and where we are exposing children to managed risk to enable them, kind of to have that really crucial stage of, adolescence and child and teenage development, where, kind of you can learn, discover, you can make mistakes, but then you know that if something goes wrong, your kid, your teen knows how to deal with that. They feel empowered and enabled to respond. The other alternative is you pull up the drawbridge, and then what? You suddenly let a teenager loose on social media when they're 16 and they've had no exposure and no guardrails, and all of a sudden they're just, kind of exposed to, all the misogynistic content that's still there, to all of the kind of algorithmic curation of content that's still there, to all of those risks, but without any measured opportunity to be exposed to them. And that doesn't get away from the harms. It doesn't like mean that the harm gets eradicated. It means the harm gets displaced and delayed. And I would worry then actually ends up just, you're delaying harm, and the harm may actually be worse in the long run. And as you say, all of those psychological effects as well, if you are not enabling children and teenagers to, experience that managed exposure to risk, setting boundaries, learning, kind of learning how you deal with a whole variety of situations. Because, again, to go back to this kind of like child-centered point of view, online, this genie is out of the bottle and it's not going back in. Online is part of children's lives because it will grow on to be part of adults' lives. And if we are trying to, kind of artificially skew that sense of where children can and can't, go through, normal important stages of child and teen development, then, we are not driving good outcomes.
Ah, now you see, I'm still not going to name his book, but there is somebody that would suggest they only just need to climb trees to do that, right? But I would
Go
certainly
into nature and everything will be fine.
there is, yes, because this idea of play-based, and I'm like, well, then you don't understand what children are doing online in terms of they are playing and they are taking risks, but they're calculated risks in a different way. And we can't teach children, right, see that tree over there? It's great to climb, but you can't go up it in case you get hurt. Because actually, we've had many children over many years where they did get hurt in the physical realm. But certainly, as you were talking then, Andy, this goes back to everything. It's almost like everything that I want to kind of pinpoint on in terms of this is why I talk about early developmental relationships. And sadly, and this is going to sound like I'm parent pointing now, sadly, Parents are often so distracted on their own devices that children aren't getting the developmental contingent moments that are necessary to be able to have those trusting relationships to come and report and to have conversations. So for me, I see a lot of this needs to be in the developmental space. We need to be talking to people who work in early years. Sadly, we have got rid of a lot of the Sure Start centres.
Yeah.
And for me, it's the bit that writer has completely missed out of his book is actually we didn't get into the weeds in terms of what have we been doing for 27 years where and this is why I went off and did my TED talk on it in terms of that's what happens when you're tiny. And certainly working with children in therapy, they will repeatedly say, well, I'm not telling my parents because they'll take it off me. I'm not telling my teacher because they're nosy. I'm not telling. And what that's about is I don't trust those people to help me. I trust them to be punitive, to shout at me, to make me feel like, in air quotes, I did something wrong. Whereas actually, we need to flip it the opposite direction, I suspect.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And you know, whether you're talking about online or whether you're talking about offline, it's that point where, you know, kind of as you know, and you're right, starting from very young children, help, you know, is prevention, is helping to make sure that your kids kind of know how to encounter those situations, engage in those situations, having the
Yeah.
power and the agency, you know, those critical skills about, you know, kind of about staying safe, about evaluating their experiences, you know, kind of and about, you know, knowing that there should be this relationship of, you know, kind of trust and comfort. So, you know, if something bad happens, they know that they can come to you. But whether it's online or whether it's offline, you know, I love that phrase, smother mother. I'm going to take that away. I'm going to plagiarize that one ruthlessly, because that's the thing, you know, kind of like superficially, the easiest thing as a parent that you feel that you might want to do is shield your child from any potential risk. But that risk taking is a natural, really important part of development and adolescence. And, you know, the most terrifying thing to do is actually just, you know, saying, actually, sometimes you've just got to expose your children to, you know, that process of starting to go on and become adults in their own right. And, you know, actually just kind of like, you know, making sure your children can be as equipped as possible so they can then go out and have those experiences. Yeah, it's hard. Yeah, you know, it might be really tempting to just say, let's ban the thing. But actually, you know, kind of that's not how we're going to raise really successful, effective, you know, healthy children.
Yeah, another term you can possibly plagiarize. Well, you can plagiarize whatever you want because that's what plagiarism is. But my colleague wrote a book in 2012 called Bubble Wrap Children, and it was about so I've worked with this lady Helen for a long time, and she talked about children who were in the looked after system, the fostered ones, who were being contacted by family of origin mem or members of foo families. That is it always makes me think Foo Fighters. But when you are an adopted child, what she was finding is the parents would say, no, you can't go on social media, then you can't be contacted by anybody. But actually, there are now so many different routes that I'm thinking there's this thing about you know, we're not talking anything today that's any different from the early days of the internet in the ways that people could be contacted and the kinds of harms. I would say at the outset of the internet, if I wanted to see some of those harms, I had to know the URL or I had to know the particular slug on a URL to be able to find, which makes me sound like I was looking for really bad things. I might edit that bit out. But there is this space about it was in the early days, it was about a lot of fun. And yes, you went into the forums, and there is a Netflix documentary actually about 4chan, which is quite hilarious because it's omitted quite a lot out. But why wouldn't it? And then you've got children who are holding these devices in their hands. And I think what we're doing at the moment is we're making it about these smartphones, and we haven't considered the Switches, the Nintendo DSs, if they still exist, you know, the kinds of things that are the tablets. The things that children can access otherwise, because what I'm finding, Andy, and I don't know if you know about this trend, but since going on social media and doing a little bit more psychoeducation for people, I'm being contacted by those children who can't tell their parents they're suicidal. I'm being contacted for help around mental health, and I'm finding parents in my DMs, what we call trauma dumping. this has happened to my child. What should I do? Where should I go? What can I do? And there's a lot of pressure for me to answer these people. And again, I don't necessarily know that it's truthful, but if that's happening to me, that's happening to other practitioners, which means there's an unknown number of people being contacted where children cannot speak to somebody in the corporeal. And that breaks my heart.
100%. And of my years of working at the NSPCC, so often, when children are contacting, in that case, Childline or Shout or the whole range of support services, you see story after story after story of children who have then felt that they can't disclose. They're scared of speaking to a parent. They're scared of speaking to a teacher. They're scared of seeking help, and that is where, then a bad case gets worse and worse and worse, to the point that they are some of the worst, kind of cases and stories that you will come across. And it is so important. It's really easy to blame this on the device, but so much of this is about creating the culture and the space where children then feel like there is supportive people in their lives, supported adults in their lives that then they can disclose to and go and go for help. Because whatever happens online, it should never be the child's, it should never be seen as the child's fault. Children and young people need to know that.
All the child's responsibility. I find a lot, particularly with protective education, that we tend to do a lot of you should stop this happening in the first instance. Whereas perhaps we should be saying to the adults, you need to help prevent this. So we've been nattering for about an hour. So is there anything you would like to posit or suggest that we could do? Yes, this needs to be societal, that's for sure, and it needs collaborative, cooperative, co-created connections through all of those services, like the technology companies and people like yourselves. Is there anything else you'd like to pop in before we finish? Because I could talk to you all afternoon, and I know that you've got stuff to do, I've got stuff to do, but this is certainly something I want to get out fairly quickly to people.
Do you know what? Anytime I ever do, anytime I ever do, kind of I'm on the TV, I go on the radio, and the question I'm always asked is, kind of what's the single piece of advice that you could give to parents? And I would say, this is true for parents, it is true for, professionals, it is true for everyone. It is, take the time to create that space with your child and young person where the online world is a part of their lives. So make it a part of your lives, make it a part of the relationship that you have, and engage, kind of on the basis of this being a trusting, open space where, you would want your child to come to you if they have problems on any other part of their lives. Make sure that this is no different around online. And, like so many of us fall into the trap that online is somehow different. It's somehow different, it's somehow scarier, it's somehow harder, but it's a part of your child's lives. So actually, we can make this really complicated. We can be really scared about all of the apps that we don't know and all of the risks that we don't know and and all of the language that we don't know and all of the things that kind of confuse and and scare us and make those conversations, kind of like difficult to have. Whether you're a parent, whether you're a teacher, whatever relationship you have with children, actually just create the space where you recognize that this is a part of children's lives, and they can come to you, you can help them, and if something goes wrong, then you can work through it together. And it's sometimes the most simple advice, the most fundamental advice is the most important one. And on this one, kind of it doesn't matter if it's online, offline, it's a part of your child life, and so work with them, not to them.
Beautifully put. I would say I succinctly put that in my training, usually by ending with, and it's conversations, 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 which here we've had a stunning conversation in terms of being able to put this information out. There is so much more for people to learn about. So where can people follow you? Because I really want to tell them about your Substack. Where can people learn from you? Come and see what you're doing on social media.
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter because it will always be Twitter and never X. I am underscore Anthony
Not caught ever.
Burrows. And I have a Substack as well if you want to hear my extended rants on the nature of all things online. So you can find me on Substack or you can find the link on my Twitter page.
Yep, and I will be putting that in the show notes. As gosh, that makes me sound like a podcaster in the show notes. Also, I would suggest and recommend to people that they do go and read your Substack. It is far more than we could get into here today, and certainly you'll see where Andy's passion comes from in terms of trying to make the changes to make technology safer in the best way that we can. So, thank you very much for the conversation.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.